Good morning. Can people hear me okay?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. So I've just thrown this image up. I'm a child and adolescent psychotherapist, a psychiatric nurse by training too, and I work predominantly in the NHS, but also privately. But in the NHS, I work with families where severe child abuse has taken place, and we're working with parents trying to either reunify them after the abuse with their children. In some cases, we are removing or assisting in the removal of those children. But it's quite difficult and tough work. I will be presenting some dream material from a mother in shortly. But this image relates to a program we run where we are working with the parents psychoeducationally as well as therapeutically, using actually a mentalization-based treatment approach, for those of you that know that. We commissioned the children's illustrator, Jane Ray, to do some images that would capture some of the key concepts around attachment and around psychoanalytic concepts, in fact, to try and get some of these across to the parents. The reason it's there is because one of the images, I insisted, needed to represent something of the unconscious. So the top roundel is called Night Sees. And one of the things we do in that session with parents is get them to respond to the images just in free association. And so very interestingly, for instance, in a recent group, one mother said, "I think the mermaid is what happens in those dreams where something protects you from the deep of your unconscious that might come up and the monsters in the deep," which hadn't occurred to me before. But as you can see, there's a child asleep. And the message we overall give to parents is, look, actually, bedtimes, statistically, it's one of the times when children get injured, is at night time, when parents are stressed, tired, and resentful of children waking and disturbing their evenings. But also, we recognize that going off to sleep for children and for adults can be a very frightening thing. In fact, one father, very tough, antisocial personality disorder father, said, "Well, every night I struggle to go to sleep because I'm frightened I will die." Anyway, so that's the reason that image is there. So today's theme is the creative unconscious, so it seemed only fitting that we should spend some time thinking about dreams and slips of the tongue. According to Freud, both rich sources for understanding and exploring conscious processes. Indeed, it could be said before Freud, dream analysis was either not taken seriously or taken seriously only by those who looked to dreams as one of many methods of divination, such as astrology, palmistry, numerology, and tarot cards. Joseph's interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams in Genesis would be one ancient example. Now, of course, today, there are still many of us who still seek to know the future through divination of one kind or another. Now, this was brought home to me very forcibly when I was pressured some 20 years ago now into playing the role of a fortune teller at a Christmas bazaar in the children's psychiatric hospital where I worked. The lady who organized the bazaar was a mature Irish woman who was terrifying. So I when Maggie said this had to happen, it had to happen. So believing I would be besieged by children wishing to know what they were getting for Christmas, I put up a sign announcing that Giraldus, the gypsy fortune teller, and his magic bear, or her magic bear, would tell your fortune for 50p. As I had a beard in those days, I can only think that I must have thought the children would find it funny that I was wearing a dress and had chocolate Christmas tree decorations hanging from around my ears. I had a teddy who wore a cloak, and my routine, which I'd practiced on one or two children on the inpatient unit, included dealing some tarot cards, having a conversation, a whispered conversation with the bear who'd whisper in my ear and say something nice about the children and about what they're going to get for Christmas. While I was getting ready, Maggie put her head round the curtain and said, "Could you get a move on because there's a queue outside?" I looked out, and instead of a queue of children or even a queue of parents with their children, there was a queue of women in late, middle or old age, all looking grim and determined. The first woman to stand opposite me was not in any way fazed by my dress or my earrings, but asked, will my husband survive his present illness? Stalling for time, I asked what illness did he have, and she answered lung cancer. The earrings came off, the bear stayed silent, and for the next 3 hours I effectively counselled approximately 20 mothers, women, and only one child whose mother had dropped her off. I promised nothing was certain, and a good number of them, I asked them to promise that they would go to their GP next week and make an appointment for support or for some therapeutic work. I was shocked not only by their willingness to believe, in spite of the ridiculous nature of my garb and the clear lack of confidence, but I think I was more shocked by their need to believe that I could tell something of their future and instill some certainty and perhaps some hope. Now, in contrast, just a few weeks ago, when I asked a young man who's just finished his degree, now starting therapy, if he recalled his dreams, he looked at me as if I was crazy. I don't think he would have been any more derisory if I had suggested we examine the entrails of his recently deceased cat to foretell his exam results. But nonetheless, he has said he would give it a go. But he still has yet to bring a dream. Now, I had the good fortune to be supervised for a number of years by Isabel Menzies-Lythe, the psychoanalyst and social scientist, who once asked me, when I presented material from a session with a young girl of 7 for supervision, can she swim? She believed that water, and particularly deep water, symbolized for all of us, not just children, the unconscious depths of the mind, and that a child who is afraid of water might equally balk at exploring the unconscious processes of the mind in therapy. Since then, I've carefully collected any allusions to swimming or water in any patient's dreams. One patient, for instance, a man in his late 60s, dreamt soon after starting therapy that he had gone diving in deep water, wearing an apparatus he had invented that enabled him to see down into the dark depths beneath the boat. It was borne out over the course of his therapy that he did not lack courage in facing the known and the unknown, and he was eventually able to mourn a grievous loss in childhood that had lurked beneath his awareness for most of his life. Another adolescent patient dreamt regularly of swimming out to sea, terrified of drowning, and on one occasion of swimming the channel, being chased by sharks, and barely making it alive to shore in France. She did not do so well in therapy. I failed to contain her. And eventually she broke off treatment before any real breakthrough was made in her ever-present fear of abandonment. So what do dreams tell us? Well, psychoanalysts and psychotherapists vary in how much value they place on dreams and dream analysis. I'm convinced that they are still tremendously helpful to some patients, and certainly to me as a therapist, in at least two important ways. Firstly, they often appear to offer a reasonably clear sight into the landscape and, if you like, the flora and fauna, the inhabitants, as it were, of a person's internal world, including unresolved emotional conflicts. And secondly, as Donald Meltzer stated in his book, 1983, Dream Life, that the dream process is one of thinking about emotional experiences. Symbol formation and dream work seek to struggle with and resolve emotional conflicts. He states further that he would consider dreaming to be as continuous in the mind as is digestion in the body, but concentrated more fully on the task when other mental processes of dealing with the outside world are in abeyance during sleep. So I want to illustrate this with some dream material from a young mother who came into twice weekly therapy with me for 2 years following the birth of her first daughter. She wasn't referred to our child protection assessment service. She was referred to our perinatal mental health service by her health visitor, who was alarmed at the mother's wishes to and fantasies of killing her baby. She had intrusive fantasies of wanting to drown or stab her 1-month-old infant girl. Now, the birth was traumatic by anybody's account, apart from the mother's, as she suffered postpartum bleeding and almost lost her life. However, she denied suffering any trauma and furthermore minimized the impact on her of pervasive emotional neglect by her mother and emotional abuse by her father, both of which I learned a great deal about in the therapy. She was deeply ambivalent about therapy, but dreamt prolifically and was burdened by her frequent nightmares, but found the writing down of dreams and her associations to them helpful and she quickly came to value our sense-making of this outpouring of unconscious material. She likened her brain to a dream factory, one that was constantly in production, and she couldn't stop its outpourings. Many of her dreams were claustrophobic. Many involved her incarceration in a basement or a prison where she was tortured, raped, murdered. Many involved attacks by others, including assassins who'd come to kill her daughter. One dream included my rape of her daughter in a room in the hospital. However, some dreams appeared to me over the course of the therapy and to my supervisor, Andrea Watson, who isn't here today, but who has been enormously helpful over many years in understanding a lot of these very difficult to manage parents, that the dreams not only depict the conflicts, but seem to be reaching towards some understanding or resolution. So I'll read a short series of dreams now that illustrate, I believe, and I'll put them on screen as well, both the depiction of her plight as a mother who fears that she cannot enable her baby to thrive in her heart and mind, or even keep physically safe, and some attempts, I think, in the dreams at resolution. But I'd be interested to hear what you think. So very soon in therapy, at 1 month old, baby at 1 month old, she dreamt, I had the baby in the pram, and I leant down to pick her up. I saw she was looking right at me, and suddenly she spoke. Your heart is dead, she said. No, obviously, I'm alive, I replied. Your heart is cold and fragmented, she responded. Her eyes were really startling, and I remember the focus was on these as they were old before their time, like the eyes of a 90-year-old, light blue and watery. I put her back in her pram and felt shocked that she could talk as she was just a baby. I knew what she said was true. Shall I read through a few and then perhaps we could get some responses? 2 months old. I was seeing a close friend of mine. She was having great difficulty with her baby and told me that she's pregnant again. I knew immediately that she had done this deliberately to replace the failed or failing relationship with her child with another new relationship. I thought she was a total idiot, as the baby couldn't just be written off like that, as it is and will always be part of the family. It can't just be replaced. Even in the dream, I recognised that she was me. The same night, this mother would bring dreams, half a dozen, sometimes eight or nine, from a single night, which allowed for the kind of study of a whole series of dreams as one unit, but also as individual, which was fascinating and sometimes helpful. Wasn't always helpful to do that depth of analysis. Same night then as the previous dream. I was talking to my mum about the nightmares I had as a child. Oh yes, they were terrible. We always had to put your nightlight on. Leave the door ajar and the landing light on, she said. In the next scene, my dad, mum and I were at the field that I walked the dog in, but I don't think the dog was there. My dad started laughing about the dreams I had as a child, as my mum had reminded him. He then took a pen and started drawing love, hate signs on himself, on his neck and arm, my mum and I with a thick black pen. I took it to mean that my dreams are filled with love and hate. He was chasing my mum around the field with his pen and they were both laughing. He then drew the symbols on my neck and arm. I didn't find it very funny. I then said to him, conflict in dreams is good. Okay. Shall I carry on with some more dreams or do... Okay, if you're feeling a burning need to respond, do just speak up. She dreamt she'd given birth to a second baby. This was a very convoluted dream in which another woman, a black woman, was giving birth to a baby and she was witnessing it, but it was as if she was witnessing the painful birth she had with her first baby. And when the baby came out, the baby was white and she took it knowing that this was her baby, her second baby. So I know that this is my baby. As she is born, I see that she is a girl and I am disappointed as I think I wanted a boy, not another girl. I try to shake off those feelings and find that I become very happy. I'm wearing a pastel blue scarf around my neck and ask someone to take it off for me as I want to hold my baby properly and not worry about staining the scarf. I think my sister steps forward to remove it. I hug my new baby and start crying. It feels so wonderful, but I get upset as I know that my first daughter will now be pushed aside as the feelings I have towards this baby are so different. My mum and sister start taking photos and the room is lit up with flashes from the camera every now and again. I know they are happy for me. The whole hospital room has a light blue tinge to it, similar to one of your shirts. I, as a therapist. Okay. Okay, so one more. The child is 1 year old. The patient dreams that she's attending my mother's funeral. Now, just as a point of clarification, my mother had died some 12 or 13 years before. I don't think the patient was aware of this, unless she intuited it. However, her husband's mother had died a year before the birth of her first baby, her baby, and she'd felt very cared for by this mother, in contrast to her own mother. And in the dream, at my mother's funeral, I come. She said, you'd come to make sure I was okay and was ready to go downstairs. I remember thinking that even on his mother's funeral, he is worrying about others and thinking about my own anxieties rather than being engulfed by his own. I told you I was absolutely fine and found my husband by my side. You then told me of a dream you had had. Okay, so now she's dreaming that I'm telling her a dream at my mother's funeral. So in her dream, I tell her the following. I was a baby in a Moses basket that was situated by an open window. It was nighttime, and I witnessed a little butterfly flutter in through the window and land in my Moses basket by me. I lay expecting some form of comfort to follow, perhaps a cuddle or a friendly face to peer over me, and instead, blood gushed from an unseen source and covered my face. She then continues, I had a sense in that moment, as I, the therapist, told her the dream, in her dream, that we were both on the same page, in that we were both analysing that dream in the same way. The butterfly was your mother, signalling and bringing about a feeling of change. The death of your mother had caused you to feel infantile emotions and re-experience feelings of dependency and vulnerability, and whereas in the dream it felt that the natural progression of the dream was that a friendly face would emerge to settle you, you had been met with the polar opposite, which I felt represented death, perhaps the violent shock of death, no matter how much it was anticipated. Any thoughts or responses to those dreams? You don't have to be, if you're in the audience and you're not a psychoanalyst or psychotherapist, but simply a poet or literary person, by all means do 1 minute left. Okay. So perhaps it would make sense to leave that for, yeah, okay. So other people today, better qualified than I, will speak to the creative process of writing and dreaming. Seamus Heaney said that after 1969, the problems of poetry moved from simply being a matter of finding a satisfactory verbal icon, got a bit more time, to being a search for images and symbols adequate to our predicament. Heaney was referring to troubles in Northern Ireland, but it's equally true that a valid definition of a poem is that it offers a reader a set of images or symbols adequate to his predicament. That is to say, it mirrors accurately that predicament. So perhaps it's worth exploring some questions this raises. Is every poem a dream? And every dream a poem? Okay. But what of other unconscious communications, such as parapraxis, the slipping of the tongue? Are these too also not poetic in their symbolic nature? Samuel Beckett famously said that language is a veil and that it is most efficiently used where it is most efficiently misused. A parapraxis is indeed a concise and efficient misuse of language, enabling the unconscious to infiltrate daily life and conversations. Again, in addition to my collection of dreams relating to water and swimming, I've also assembled a collection of what appear to me to be rather beautiful and often poignant poetic parapraxis and other misusings of language. I kind of fell in love with the ambiguity of idiom between languages and culture growing up in Dublin, speaking Hiberno English as my vernacular, for which the Christian Brothers leathered you in their attempts to get you to speak proper English, one half of the week, and battered you in their attempts to get you to speak proper Irish, the other half of the week. Early objects in this section of my collection include my father's parapraxis or slips or misusings. He once admired my Uncle Harry's painting, saying, actually of a man over deep water, as it happens, that he loved his use of perspex, meaning perspective. But my favourite misuse overall that I treasure above all, I collected when working on the Dublin docks as a security guard for an outfit called Acme Security. I kid you not, that was the name of the company. One of my duties was to patrol the warehouse that stored goods for import and export twice a shift. As I was shown around on my first day by an old hand, he said, "You're not actually meant to catch anyone taking anything, you know. You're only here as a detergent." Now, I knew he meant deterrent, but suddenly I was on another border, witnessing a man trying to assert himself in the same way our ridiculous blue uniforms and dreadful company name served only to undermine our attempts to convey a dignified authority, at least for me. So this misusage of the words perspex and detergent, of course, they're not true slips of the tongue, but they're more like false passports revealing the speaker's failed attempt to cross a border language, a border that language polices between different social strata. As a psychotherapist working with the families in the court arena, I hear patients use and accidentally misuse language to hide their faults and to project desirable images of their parenting. Part of my work is to try to hear the family's vernacular, the language of home life, to get a sense of the culture within the family, to sense the presences and absences of the many ghosts of former experiences and relationships, the structures and plots of family scripts already, as it were, that are ghost-written. Yet when you meet, at least for the first time, clichéd, concretized words and phrases tumble down from their mouths, like blocks in the space between you, and a wall of concrete assumptions and thoughts bar your way to the truth of the emotional life of the person and family on the other side, or indeed the lack of emotional life. When borders are demarcated so clearly by these attempts to cross them, one has to resist the temptation to be only the guard you're forced to be, so one is reliant on occasional slips of the tongue to allow a glimpse behind the veil. Again, among my collection is this beautiful phrase uttered by one young mother who was profoundly physically abused as a child and emotionally neglected. She said, "I got tired of wearing all my two sisters' hand-me-downs and put-me-downs, never having new clothes for myself." For me, the eloquence unconsciously symbolized in that phrase signaled a hopeful line of communication between conscious and unconscious processes that might enable therapeutic engagement and hope for reunification with her children. Beckett said that writers could not have a higher goal than to continue to bore one hole after another in language until what lurks behind it, be it something or nothing, begins to seep through. He added, "I cannot imagine a higher goal for a writer today. In our dreaming and in our strivings to put into poetic form something of or nothing of ourselves, or in our attempts to make sense of the poetics of the dream life of our patients, we continue to strive, or as the man himself had said again, all of old, nothing else ever, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Our next speaker has travelled from New York to be here today. We're delighted to welcome the poet and psychoanalyst Noir Al-Fadir.
This is fine, but can we put the light on?
And,
I'm still a bit jet lagged. Can you hear me?
We need it.
Okay. Yeah. Is that okay? Can everyone hear me? Okay. First of all, I want to say how thrilled I am to be here, not only here literally, but here with you, thinking about poetry and psychoanalysis, the creative unconscious. And I'd like to thank everyone who's behind my being here, Catherine Maris, Judith Palmer, and everyone at the Poetry Society and Freud Museum. As Judith mentioned, I came from New York. I live in New York, in Brooklyn in particular. And when I take the Q train one stop into Manhattan for work, it travels above ground, north over the Manhattan Bridge. There's a glorious view from the train, from the bridge, of the Brooklyn Bridge, a different bridge, straddling the East River, the Statue of Liberty, a children's park along the water, graffiti, laundry lines, and the narrow streets of Chinatown packed with color. I always make sure to position myself before a window, have vowed never to stand with my back to it, searching my phone. Occasionally, another train will pass in the opposite direction, towards Brooklyn, obstructing my view. I've made a bit of a game out of trying to catch a glimpse of the bridge or the Statue of Liberty through my window, as well as the two windows on either side of the train passing before me, which are constantly swapped out for the windows to their right due to the train's speed, an effect mingling the movement found in 8mm film with nausea. Nonetheless, each time I catch an image through the moving frames of window, I feel a piercing sensation within me and think, as Nietzsche did, of his aphorisms, little stabs at happiness. I felt a similar pleasure as a child when I used a piece of metal as a mirror to direct a beam of light to shine on a specific point in space, most often the center of my eye, creating a near painful but brilliant effect, repulsive but beautiful. This relationship I imagine being articulated between me and the universe is parallel to the one I imagine being articulated between my unconscious and conscious minds. I used to read as a child a series of books about a character called the Great Brain, who was always outsmarting the neighborhood kids. His method of problem solving, which I've carried with me all these years as precept, was to enlist his unconscious. He would think of a problem before going to bed so that the rumination was carried into sleep and worked through in his dreams. In the history of thought, there are multiple examples of visionary leaps being made through a dream or vision. The scientist, as the story goes, who conceived of the benzene molecule being shaped as a ring, for example, saw a vision of snakes biting their own tails. Years ago, I was struggling to find the right pronoun to use in my poetry. I found myself most moved by poems in the first person, but after having studied with poets who use their life stories as material for their work, I somehow developed a kind of allergy to confessional poems and did not want my person to enter my poetry in that way. I've been playing with the speaker in my poems, trying to figure out how I could keep the work lyric, have an I addressing a thou, while not using an I that matched with me, the person who tripped while exiting the house or had two eggs for breakfast. During that period, I had a dream in which what I call my dream voice told me, the fourth person singular exists in the fourth dimension. That piece of wisdom led to an exploration of the fourth dimension and theories of physics, which helped me to understand this concept of the fourth person singular, an idea I never could have consciously willed to mind, but seemed and still seems just right to me. I won't go into it now. Trusting what comes out of you is not always easy. Winnicott described the manifestation of what he termed the true self in the spontaneous gestures of an infant. If the good enough mother is able to affirm and accept those gestures as they are, the true self is encouraged to show itself, whereas the mother who frowns at or corrects the gesture will condition the infant to replace the spontaneous gesture with a gesture that will please her. And in this, one sees the birth of a false socialized self. In the world of the adult, those same spontaneous eruptions from our interior, gestures, sounds, slips of the tongue, incite embarrassment, even as they similarly express our life force, whether considered the true self or the id. We board up the access route for reasons having to do with what we believe to be unacceptable. Roland Barthes, in discussing his response to photographs, describes two elements, the studium and the punctum. The studium represents the manifest meaning of a photograph, what is evident to anyone who looks at it, whereas the punctum, as Barthes puts it, rises only from certain images that have a chance resonance with one's interior, and it's experienced as a kind of prick, an accident, he writes, which pricks, bruises me. My conscious contemplation of what kind of speaker to use in my poems when I was awake is the studium. But the dream thought of the fourth person singular existing in the fourth dimension is the punctum, something spontaneous that slips through, thrilling yet destabilizing, because at base, my inquiry led me to realize what I most often think of as myself is perhaps less a subject than an effect of external forces, like the mother's reaction, a direct object of the external world. The punctum is the prick, creating a small pinhole through which something unexpected or unknown pokes through. It is then that I have access to the I that is not given. Whether I call it the unconscious or the true self, it is an eruption from my interior, and it isn't always pretty. The series of puncta, the little stabs of happiness I experience at the window of the Q train, make me feel both queasy and moved. Aesthetics, as Freud points out in The Uncanny, in general, this is a quotation, in general, prefer to concern themselves with what is beautiful, attractive, and sublime, that is, with feelings of a positive nature, and with the circumstances and the objects that call them forth, rather than with the opposite feelings of repulsion and distress. In the same way that the sublime is both terrifying and beautiful, the punctum, which I'm seeing as the pinhole through which the unconscious momentarily escapes, is destabilizing but exhilarating. What I can name, writes Bart, cannot really prick me. If what you can name cannot prick you, how can you bring the punctum into language when interactions with the world, inner and outer, seem dulled, not pointed enough to poke through? This was my dilemma during a period in which I was unable to write anything that felt alive. I didn't know quite what to do about it. It was a massive writer's block. And so I developed a method, which was to set my alarm for 3:15 a.m. I would go to bed with a notebook on my bedside table with a pen marking a blank page, and at hearing the alarm, wake and write down whatever was at the top of my mind. The fragments from sleep bring with them the same kind of piercing stab at, if not happiness in the classic sense, happiness in my peculiar sense. Marion Moore once wrote, "We must have the courage of our peculiarities." And that, for me, is of having made a connection to some aliveness, some life force within. The first few nights, my writing was unintelligible. By morning, I couldn't even make out what the words were. I started to write more largely and give myself bigger notebook and 2 pages. And then the fragments started to come through. First, they came in chopped form, and soon they began to pour out of me. I was writing 6, 7, 8 fragments in a 3 to 4 minute time period. Here's an example of a series from a single night. Back to zero, all debts paid, after the clock changes from 3:09 to 3:10. My mind converting chatter to dissolving pieces of air, echatteration. The basis of revolution. We should not be very loud in here. The house, the father talking about suicide, aftermath. Is it always mourning for survivors? My mind opened like a dog jumping to bite. I'm sure I'm breaking the rules. Let me hear them from those who care. Why do scabs itch? Wasn't the initial pain enough? It's really only one metaphor in variation. Who are you whose story evaporates? Mourners bend over your body, the book, murmuring prayers. I come to pay my respects late to the ceremony, murmuring your story's ascension. Your wing, the ocean has been still for centuries, transpiring, transpiration. You will not know in this lifetime your story, who you are. Don't fake it, poison, muddle through. I want to be sure to draw a distinction between writing down these fragments and writing down dreams. I was not trying to understand my psyche, my associations, my unconscious wishes, as one might in a psychoanalytic session when recalling a dream. I was trying to make myself available to the punctum and what flowed through, to gain access to the voice and syntax of my unconscious. The bird-like chatter of this fragment compels me. You can see that he's a faintsman, wild hunter warrior, a kind of man like a kind of bird, Ren, but not Ren. As there is no sense of time in the unconscious, the voice of the fragments seems to speak from a timeless place. My story, like the one in one of the fragments above, evaporated. I finally found my fourth person singular, as in the following fragment. It's hard to come back from a grand phase, morning most difficult, its shadow a tucked under tail bringing us back to this century. What century is it? I can't see your hairstyle. That fragment I actually submitted with a batch of poems to a magazine. To my surprise, it was selected and published. The editor later forwarded a letter he received about the poem along with his response. The letter read, I have read and tried to analyze Noir Al-Sadir's poem Grand Phase, but have come up with nothing. I believe it is a very intellectual poem, and I would really like to be able to interpret it. Would you mind emailing me a brief analysis or summary of this poem? His response. Perhaps the words of two other writers would be helpful here. He had no idea that it was a night fragment. He thought it was a poem. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to say it's not a poem. That's another topic for discussion. But his response was, perhaps the words of two other writers would be helpful here. Gertrude Stein, when asked how one might go about understanding her notoriously difficult poetry, responded, if you enjoy it, you understand it. And Ludwig Wittgenstein once wrote, do not forget that although poetry is written in the language of information, it is not written in order to give information. Interestingly, one of my night fragments invokes Gertrude Stein's partner, Alice B. Toklas. Why the panic, Alice B. Toklas? Why the uncooked egg? Other fragments invoke Stein's style. Here's an example. All messy maybe, so messy it can't stay on the page. A plane flying too low, an idea like a plane flying too low, a person like a plane too low flying, too loud and louder before the crash. It is always September 11th in New York. The second quotation from Wittgenstein, although poetry is written in the language of information, it is not written in order to give information, is particularly interesting to me in conjunction with the night fragments and the question of what is being transmitted through poetry, through these fragments. They feel to me lyric, perhaps not in a traditional two-party way, with an I and a thou, but in the sense that the fourth person singular feels like an I and a simultaneous not I. One part of my psyche addresses another. Here are a few more fragments. Part truth is untruth, the way multiplying a negative number with a positive gives you a negative regardless of value. It has to be put away, the feeling, quick, drop it in the small pocket, lock it up. The following fragment has lodged itself in my mind. I think of it as a dream fractal. You think you're going deeper into the hole, but are merely skirting the surface of smaller internal parts. Perhaps all of my night fragments are, in a sense, fractals, repeating patterns self-similar across different scales. Maybe that's what was meant by the fragment that said, it's really only one metaphor and variation. Or why it's been so difficult for me to figure out how to end this talk. I think I'm going deeper into the hole, but maybe I'm merely skirting the surface of smaller internal parts. For that reason, I've decided, in lieu of conclusion, to end with the following fragment. The sheet won't stay on the corner of this moment, keeps pulling up to reveal the blankness beneath. Elastic gives a false sense of resonance. Like eating grapes. Thank you.
So I think we have some time for questions and discussion. Yes. Did you?
Thank you.
And the idea of the fourth person, the idea of the fourth person singular is a wonderful idea. What really amazed me about what you were describing was the way that you were in a position somehow, mentally or emotionally, at 3:15 a.m. or whenever it was, to enable the pieces of writing to remain as fragments, because I would have thought even the degree of consciousness which enables you to write would have imposed a kind of continuity onto the writing, so that they would somehow have had to relate to each other in your mind. So I kind of wanted to know if you could describe more about this. Was it a trance-like state, or how would you describe that state of mind?
I was still, I would think I was still almost asleep, because the alarm would go off and I would just write. Sometimes I would keep my eyes closed. I wasn't looking at what I was writing. But there were moments when, for example, I remember one fragment. I don't remember the fragment, but I remember part of the fragment is my writing double G. I think song was the word, and I put two G's at the end, and then I added double G, as though maybe later I wouldn't recognize that the double G was intended, so I wanted to make sure later I retained the double G. So there was that consciousness, and some of them have repetitions where I think there's enough consciousness for me to know that I wanted myself to get it right later when I read over it. I don't think it was fully like a sleep state, but it was that in between, crepuscular state of consciousness.
Can I say, Daniel created the image that was on the flyer, and you had a butterfly landing, and you had a bat.
I was wondering, how long were you writing for? Was it, you know, generally the same amount of time, or sometimes was it almost nothing, and sometimes it was more of a...
It was usually 30 seconds to 3 minutes, it tops. But if it really got over a minute and a half, I wouldn't be able to fall asleep. And that was always my ultimate goal, was to go back to sleep. I mean, in the moment.
And when you woke up naturally, whenever that was, did you have any kind of, what was your, how conscious were you of what you had written? Did that still kind of haunt you, or was it present, or had it all been, once you've written down, was it like, that's it? I almost no memory of that all.
That's a really good question. I think that with dreams, because I've written down my dreams before, when I write down my dreams, then the entire dream unravels. But I think with these fragments, that doesn't happen in the same way. I think they're moments, and they don't necessarily, they're probably attached. I'm sure they're attached to whatever was happening in the dream in the moment, but they don't really have that golden thread-like quality where I can get back into that moment in the dream and then recall what was around it.
Thank you.
Still on the same subject, these fragments,
yes.
Once you are awake in the morning, do you go back to them to try and build a poem with them?
I have tried that. It hasn't been very successful when I've tried. They're self-sufficient. When I first started writing them, I would try to build a poem around them. But then everything I built around them was conscious, and it was difficult to, I could continue the syntax in some ways, but it was false. There was just a sense of a lot of filler so that I could have the fragment and call it a poem. So I struggled a lot with it. And when I ultimately, I mean, I've published that one that I read as a poem on its own, and then I took fragments and I put them together in changed order into a poem that's sort of a long poem of fragments. And in that, I didn't try to make the fragments the inspiration for a poem.
You did not.
I tried and I could not. I would have loved to have. That would have been a great end to this process, I think, if it led to poems. Well, no, I'm happy with the end. I guess I should be happy with what I have.
Hi, thank you both for those wonderful talks. Jerry talked about a poem being a dream, or rather asked the question, is a poem a dream? And my ears pricked up because shortly before my mother died, she was lying in bed. I was sitting next to the bed, and I thought she was sleeping or in that kind of sleep before death. And then she suddenly said to me, murmured to me, I've got a poem for you. Because she knew I was a poet, and I think she wanted to, like, share it with me. And so I was, like, torn between not wanting her to get tired, but, like, really thinking, my God, I want to hear what this is. So I whipped her, you know, a good writer. I had a notebook with me and stuff, and I kind of said to her, yeah. And in three bursts, well, not bursts, but in three, you know, weak, struggling sessions, she dictated this, it was a dream. It was an incredible dream. She's Greek, and she's got all that kind of oral storytelling behind her. So she dictated this amazing, symbol-rich dream to me. And also, I suspected, and I don't know whether to feel guilty about this, because, you know, you give morphine and stuff to dying people. So although she'd never touched a drug in her life, I thought she maybe was a bit high as well, you know, which released all this, but it was really stunningly beautiful. It's called The Fern Man. And then I've taken it and she did give me permission when she was, you know, like when she was more conscious, she gave me permission. She said, anything I tell you, you, as a writer, you can use it. So I felt I could use it. So I fiddled with it and then I turned it into a poem, and I just recently read it I haven't published it or shared it much, but I've read it at a few poetry readings and prefaced it with, you know, telling everybody what it's about. And it really does come across, but it's sort of halfway between, you know, like a dream and a poem. So I was just really interested, because both of you, like, really into that area, with what you would say about that. What's the borderline between a dream like that and a poem?
It's a lovely story and moment, and how lucky you are that you had that with your mother in those final moments. It's beautiful. I think that maybe it's both. It's a poem, certainly, and you've turned it into one, and it probably was one as she presented it as a poem. Maybe it's from a dream. Maybe it's a poem from a dream. It's also interesting that you talk about feeling that you have the right to the permission, and I understand why. At the same time, it reminds me of a psychoanalytic session, in the sense that the dream that comes into the session, it's not so important that the dream matches the dream you had as a solitary sleeper, but there's something that's happening in the room, in the dynamic between the dreamer and the analyst, and in telling the dream, you're creating something in dialogue with the person who's with you. And so in a sense, even though it was coming from her and she was telling it to you, your very presence was part of its creation, and so it you're in it already.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So, kind of few thoughts. One is that certainly for me, I ask the question, but I often feel that a dream is a kind of poem. Obviously, it suffers then having to be translated into the verbal language, say from very symbolic and beautifully drawn. If you're very visual in your dreams, for instance, so we may fail at getting the poetic nature of it across once we try to put it into words. But nonetheless, I think you use a lovely phrase that the punctum is a pinhole through which the unconscious may escape. And one of the ways in which it escapes, which I'm sure is true of your mother and true of my mother when she told me dreams, was that two things are happening. One is one feels very privileged to hear something so intimate as a dream of someone you're close to. Secondly, and that may contain information. One dream my mother told me contained information about her as a child and her relationship with my father, which is very, very interesting. But also it's an unconscious speaking to an unconscious, and I can't know about my pinhole back into my unconscious and what's going to be generated on that side. But trust in the process that sometimes in conversations, if someone shares a dream with you, you may not know in what way your unconsciouses are speaking to each other, but trust that, that's going on and that might be a kind of a very rich symbolic language that is equally, if not more important sometimes than the conversation we share.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have a question for Jerry. It was a general question as well.
Okay.
I was thinking about the difference between children's and adult dreams and whether you'd noticed much difference. You know, could you say there's a qualitative difference? And then in that context, I was thinking about nightmares and children who have a lot of nightmares, and whether those nightmares could be considered as poems too, in some way or other, or, you know, are nightmares in a different category?
I feel tempted to go into another anecdote. Is it okay to go into another anecdote? Okay, so we have five children, and when our third child was born, our second child was coming up to age three. He was 1 month off being three. And he... Is that better? Maybe the microphone needs to go up. So our three-year-old son, or almost three, came running into our bedroom one night in distress after a nightmare and woke me up. And he said, "Daddy, can we get a new baby?" And I said, "We've just got one." And he said, "No, can we get a new baby?" And I said, "We've got one. Davy, he's in the cot." And he said, "No, Davy's head has fallen off. It's in the garden. I just touched it and it fell off." So being a child psychotherapist, I think, well, you don't need to be a psychotherapist to know what's going on, really. Now, interestingly, over the intervening years, so when Davy was coming up to age five, Owen was into writing poetry. And on the way back from school one day, he'd written a poem, which I can almost remember verbatim, but it went like this. Davy is nice. He's not like rotten rice. Davy is cute. He's not a mute. Davy doesn't smell like stinky hell. Okay? So, when I use this in teaching, I ask my students, "What do you think is going on?" If you got a Valentine's card that said, "I love you because you don't smell," would you feel you have something to worry about? So, and then on Davy's birthday, he gave Davy a birthday card with a picture of Davy on the front. Davy is five, and inside it said, "Dear Davy, happy birthday. Here is a poem. Davy, Davy, doesn't drive me crazy. Davy, Davy, he is five. Thank goodness he is still alive." When we read the poem out, we hadn't seen this. When we read the poem out, Davy said, "But why should I be dead?" Failing to see, I think, that the 5 years of being pushed down the stairs or knocked over in play were actually attempts on his life. So I think in his poetry at age five and in his dreams at age three, he's containing something of the malevolent and the ambivalent, certainly, but the malevolence he felt towards this new baby in the house, but expressing it in a very contained form that actually allowed for the genuine survival of, at times at least, a kind of reciprocally content relationship with his brother. Does that answer your question? Okay, there we go. Thank you.
Hi, sorry. I had a question for Nua. So it seemed to me that your night fragments, or the sort of procedure you're following, has a lot of similarities to the experiments the surrealists did in terms of automatic writing. And I was just wondering whether you'd tried the sort of more traditional kind of automatic writing, and if so, or based on your knowledge of it, whether you think the results of your procedure sort of tend to be different from that more traditional kind of automatic writing, and if so, sort of why that would be.
I think I have tried automatic writing. This strategy developed out of a period when I was so boring to myself that nothing I thought seemed interesting. So I was trying to believe that I was interesting. I just couldn't access what was interesting about myself. So the automatic writing, there are some techniques that work for me. Usually if it's, I think Catherine is going to talk about Joe Brainard and I Remember his poem, that kind of a technique where there's a device where I can repeat something and get into an incantatory mode helps me bring up the material or even interesting syntax. But, or like Shanagan, the ancient poet who had a book of lists, she used to write lists, like things that quicken the heart, and then it would be things that quicken the heart. I can do that, but it's more conscious because it has a theme of some kind, whether it's I remember and then I'm remembering something, or I've given myself a category and then I'm going to list things that come up. So it doesn't work, though, for me to just sit and write. I mean, I do sit and write, but I don't know why. If you have any suggestions, I'd appreciate it. How I might do that, because it would be helpful.
Yes, I'd like to ask. You said that you couldn't craft these fragments into poems by building on them. I was wondering if by any chance, in retrospect, you found that the fragments had affected the direction of your subsequent dreams and that you were able to use those as poems. And just before you answer, I just like that there's a sort of correspondence between you talking about whether the pinholes line up with the other person and you looking through the double windows of the double trains.
Oh, that's lovely.
That was a very nice kind of overlap.
Can I add something to your question?
Yeah.
Sure. Which was that I wondered similarly whether in fact you were able to look at poems written previously and to discern what night fragments may have been part of the inspiration to write, for instance.
To answer that, I have in my book a long poem of fragments, and there are night fragments in it. I didn't conceive of them as such. I mean, they were night fragments. They were things that I remembered when I woke up and I wrote down. How it's affected my dreaming is interesting because I have noticed that sometimes I'll have a dream and it's still in my dream, but there's a more conscious part of my sleeping self that will say, that's a great line. I should write it down. Oh, I should use that. And then I rarely do actually wake up to write it down. But I have a sort of double consciousness while I'm sleeping, where I'm watching myself, listening to myself in sleep, searching for good stuff, good material.
T.S. Eliot said that these fragments I've shored against my ruins. What do you think might have happened to your writing had you not pursued this 3:15 a.m. project?
That's a really interesting question. I think what was happening in my writing, which helps me think about what would have happened, was that I was trying so hard. I wasn't really able to write poems as I'd been writing them before. And I was trying really hard to write poems. And there was a dead quality to them, I felt. And I probably would have gone into form. And there's nothing wrong with form, but I probably would have tried to find, because I experimented with that a little bit, some other way to have a strategy that could release something. Because I think in form also, you can, once you get the hang of it, you can, a lot more can just flow out unconsciously. I used to be a dancer, and it was the same with dance. Once you knew the dance so well, you were able to do it on an unconscious level and more of your, I have a better analogy than dance, actually. I used to be a waitress, and when I got very good at knowing exactly what was served and what I needed to bring back to the tables for it, I would almost do the job automatically, and then without thinking, and then at the forefront of my thought, I would think poems. I used to write them on my order pad. And in fact, I remember I had a dream once that I was waiting tables. It was like my world was inverted. I was dreaming about the job and I was writing poetry while waiting tables. But I had a dream that I was taking someone's order and they said they wanted a mozzarella sandwich. And I said, okay, would you like corn relish or black bean salad with that? And then I had another dream, and then I went to another dream. And then a few dreams later, I thought, oh, I forgot the corn relish. So it's almost as though I think we can do things in our lives that are incantatory or take an automatic quality after there's repetition or the Sufis whirling, you know, and then you can create a release of some kind.
You said can I give you the microphone?
You said that you started the waking at 3:15 because you thought you were boring and you were looking for something interesting. Did that period of time change the way you looked at yourself?
Absolutely. It really did, because it made me realize how much has to do with how I live my life as opposed to what's inside me.
And I think we have time for one more last question.
Maybe two, I think. It's a question for both of you, really. I just wondered how much, in your interpretation of your clients' or patients' dreams, how much that helped you to understand what was going on in your own dreams, in the same way when you read a poem by someone else, it might help you to understand what you are trying to say.
Do you want to take that one?
Well, I think, again, I don't think he's the only person to say it, but Donald Malice said every analysis or treatment is a self-analysis, because inevitably, and I can't remember who it was that said that the patient is working on the analyst's problem. The idea being that in some way where you're going to be blocked will match something of the nature of the work that needs to be done, I think. I don't know that I... and certainly sometimes one dreams about the patient, which one can kind of take in a number of ways. One is that it might be intrusive, that one feels burdened by day and by night by something that's particularly difficult to make sense of. I know that in supervision recently with another therapist who's working with a very disturbed borderline mother who had kissed her unexpectedly as she left the session, and then was outraged when this was taken up as in the next session. My trainee dreamt that
a dead skinned body of a small animal had been left on her doorstep. And that seemed to be her trying to make sense of this very noxious projection into her from the patient. But at least that was my understanding of it. I think that's a very inadequate answer to your question. I don't have anything more eloquent, I'm afraid.
I think also in some ways, like what I was talking about in Winnicott's notion of the true and false self, where if the mother replaces her response to the infant will shape the infant's sense of what they're feeling inside or what their interior. I think there's a really subtle way in which I also can influence what comes out of the patient. So it's not necessarily even conscious. Sometimes if something is on my mind, like I remember once I was in the morning, I'd wondered if I was pregnant. I was wondering, am I pregnant? And then everybody who came into session was talking about how they were wondering if they were pregnant or they wanted to get pregnant. And everybody was talking about pregnancy. One patient even said, are you pregnant? And I wasn't, but it communicated somehow. And so many uncanny things like that happen that I know I must be transmitting it in some way. And so even in relaying a dream, that same process must be at work. Even in what I highlight, if I pursue the dream, it's going to influence what the associations are, the trail they take.
The one last question here.
Really interesting. Night fragments. It seems to me that what you're able to do with that is that daily clutter of the self, that forward rush of the day where you're always not in the position that you currently are, but moving towards what you need to be doing in 5 minutes' time. And you've managed to get rid of all of that because you're asleep. And so what you come up with is maybe it's thought or maybe it's language of itself or maybe it's the subconscious, who knows. But it would be very interesting to carry that forward in some way to day fragments, because sometimes one sits down to write a poem with intention or you take a conscious thought that you've had and you try and work it forward. It would be wonderful to be able to get rid of the clutter of the day while you were awake.
I actually have done, I do that, and what I have is a really cheesy sketchbook that says, day is, like one day, one sketch, or something like that on the cover, and it just gives you a little bit of space, and I just write something in that space. And I usually do it on the train, because I spend so much time on the train. And the train has become my office, essentially. And I just try to write whatever comes out without editing it or thinking about it, just to see what I get. And then it's interesting to put them side by side, and they don't necessarily always sound like the same person. Of course they are, but it's also interesting to take them at different times, like late at night or in the morning. And they're very different in depending on the weather. Is it freezing outside? Is it a hot day? All of that, I try to record the weather, the time, the day, where I am.
Well, thank you both so much. We now a break for half an hour where there is tea, coffee, biscuits in the other room. But before that, please, everyone, say thanks very much, Noir Al-Sadir and Jerry Jones.
Thank you. Thank you.